Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Tom Merle, and I am the culprit in all this for arranging this evening. And thanks to the Independent Institute, we are actually pulling this off. I am on the program committee of the Commonwealth Club. I also run a forum, a members-sponsored forum at the club called Cultural Currents. Those of you who are Commonwealth Club members, and those of you who are not, may know that it's a two-tier club. You have staff-sponsored events where they bring in a President Bush, someone like that, and they have a number of subject matter sections. They used to be called study sections. They would come up with reports on bay quality and so forth. It really does expand the program there. I have, for about 2 years, been looking at the issue of gender relations, men and women, good times, bad times, how do we all get along, and also some of the other issues dealing with human relations. And it's my feeling, people, that the club, Commonwealth Club, could benefit from having some points of view different than those from the usual sorts of the grievance committee, those people who say that things are just terrible and what are we going to do about it. We need a little more positive perspective, and I think that's what the Independent Institute brings to it. So I'm very pleased to partner with David Thoreau on this, and he can bring his mighty apparatus of a staff to do this. I also must thank Carol Haymeyer. She's a colleague, a program committee member, and when I said Wendy McElroy is coming to San Francisco on her way to Las Vegas, could we inject maybe her point of view at our program committee meeting? Well, we kind of sprung it on them and caught them by surprise. And so she and I said, well, we have to find another venue, because the club now tonight is hosting Sylvia Nasser, the author of A Beautiful Mind. And that was in the works for 3 months, and that pulled in a good 250 people. So Carol was able to get this space, and that's why we're here in this luxurious surroundings. So thanks a lot, Carol, and to the Charter 100 group who are here.
100.
Yes, because they're also co-sponsoring along with the other two organizations.
And Barbara, who's the head, is
right here. Oh, great, Barbara. Yes, be a friend of Barbara. And I asked what are the qualifications? Be a friend of Barbara. Friend of Bill, friend of Barbara. Yeah. Let's get going with the talk, and to introduce our speaker, David Thoreau, the president of the Independent Institute, will discuss, I think, something about the Institute and also about Wendy McElroy and why you should all pay a lot of attention to Wendy McElroy. David Thoreau.
Well, thank you, Tom. Can everybody hear all right? Can anybody not hear? Of course, you won't raise your hand. I want to thank everyone for joining with us. My name is David Thoreau. I'm the president of the Independent Institute, and it's a real pleasure to be co-sponsoring this evening's program with the Commonwealth Club and with Charter 100. The Institute regularly holds events in the Bay Area here, which consist of seminars and debates and lectures and panel discussions on many different public issues. Many of them are held at our conference center in Oakland, but we also hold events in San Francisco and elsewhere. As you know, our program tonight is entitled Liberty for Women. And our speaker is the author, columnist, and scholar, Wendy McElroy. For those of you who have not seen her new book, it's just come out, oddly enough called Liberty for Women also. We think this book is going to be a dynamo. And if you have even a vague interest in issues pertaining to gender or to women's issues more specifically, I highly recommend this book, because you'll find it fascinating, challenging, and hopefully of value. We just have the new issue of Publishers Weekly, which is a trade magazine on the book business, just review the book, and the review said, quote, any book endorsed by both Playboy's Christy Hefner and the nation's Alexander Coburn is likely to raise eyebrows. And indeed, this book is going to do that. For those of you who are new to the Independent Institute, there are packets at the registration table. Many of you may have picked up copies. Please also visit our website. We, of course, have a website, as you might guess, independent.org. In addition to the many projects you'll find on the website, you can also read or listen to past events, which we hold. The most recent event we held was here in San Francisco, the Herbst Theater, with Gore Vidal and a panel on the terrorist war. Our next event will be next Tuesday in San Francisco, entitled The Real Abraham Lincoln, A Debate. And it will feature the renowned Lincoln scholar Harry Jaffa from Claremont McKenna College and Thomas DiLorenzo from Loyola College of Maryland. And the sparks, I guarantee, will be flying. More specifically, the Independent Institute is a scholarly public policy research institute, and we sponsor many studies by various scholars. We produce many books. We have a quarterly journal. More specifically, the women's movement arose, as many of you may know, in the early 19th century as an offshoot of abolitionism, the anti-slavery movement that declared that each person was a self-owner. As with other abolitionists, the early feminists were individualists who drew inspiration from the Declaration of Independence and its principles of individual rights and responsibility. The vision of individualist feminism boldly explored a wide range of issues that confront the modern woman as well as the woman of the 19th century, including issues like self-defense, economic well-being, employment, sex and abortion, the family, and much more. And in this new book that I mentioned, Liberty for Women, it explores these in quite a number of fascinating and intriguing ways. The new feminism, we believe, celebrates the possibility of individuals living in a free society and being treated in a respectful and appropriate manner. And that, in many respects, is drawing upon the work of Wendy McElroy. The key to a lot of this is the issue of choice. Individuals making their own peaceful choices in all aspects of their lives. And this means that the choices that women make, or any individual should make, we believe should be respected, because those are choices they feel most comfortable with. Those are the choices that they find most rewarding and productive for their lives. Our speaker, Wendy McElroy, we're very pleased, is a research fellow at the Independent Institute. She is a columnist at foxnews.com. She's the editor of the popular website ifeminist.com. It's plural, ifeminist.com. In addition to Liberty for Women and the other book I just mentioned, her books include Sexual Correctness, The Reasonable Woman, Dissenting Electorate, Queen Silver, and others. She's also the editor, or was the editor, of a very influential and highly recommended series of audio tapes that were produced by Knowledge Products on philosophy, on war, on the Constitution, and many other areas. She's a contributing editor to and author to numerous publications and volumes. I highly recommend all of her work, and you can find that on her website. So without further delay, it's a pleasure to introduce Wendy McElroy.
Good evening. 21st century feminism, which is what my talk is about, is individualist feminism, what I call I-feminism, because the old establishment of feminism is crumbling, and it's crumbling fast. The National Organization for Women lost over 50% of its membership as a result of the hypocritical stands it took when President Clinton did his serial abuse of women, and it's still falling. A cash-starved Miss Magazine recently merged with the feminist majority in order to merely survive. And issues like affirmative action, which were unquestioned and unquestionable 10 years ago, court decisions are now being found that the military cannot discriminate against white men in favor of blacks or women, and state legislatures are debating them seriously. The hottest ticket in terms of a debate in feminism right now is whether you can have a baby in a career This came from Sylvia Ann Hewitt's book, recently coming out, in which she basically said that professional women had waited too long. Karen Hughes resigning from the Bush as a consultant to go back to her family in Texas has re-raised the question, can women have it all? One of the things I've noticed when I've gone around, because I've been going to American campuses and lecturing, one of the things I've noticed is that there's a reaction within the old guard of feminism, if you want. In November, I went and did a lecture tour of American universities with Kathleen Barry. And Kathleen Barry is a feminist, a radical feminist, who's well known for her views on prostitution. And I was amazed. I was really very surprised. She was amazed as well. And the thing that was surprising is no one wanted to listen to what she had to say. No one wanted to hear the old line. At the end of the tour, she went to the lecture agent who had arranged it and said that she would no longer talk in public on prostitution and pornography, which were the two issues we were debating. The agent went and tried to find a replacement. He went down a virtual honor list of radical feminists and was unable to find anyone, even for very good money, who was willing to stand up and talk, because they realize there is a sea change going on. There's a sea change in feminism. It's away from the old establishment. It's toward what I would call liberty, libertarianism, I-feminism, whatever you want to call it. Now, tonight what I want to do is introduce you to what is the new mode, the new model, what is 20th century feminism, which is going to replace the old paradigm, because the old paradigm is dying. It no longer addresses the needs, the questions, the realities of the 21st century woman. And what I want to do is begin by contrasting some of the very basic ideas of individualist feminism, of I-feminism, with those of establishment feminism, which is sometimes called politically correct feminism, radical feminism, or gender feminism. And I want to do this because I want you to get a sense that the disagreement that exists between these two traditions of feminism is not merely on issues. It's not merely that I take a different position on affirmative action than Gloria Steinem would. It's that there's a fundamental difference. There are opposing ideologies. Now, I want you to get a sense of how profoundly these two traditions oppose each other, because what's happening is a sea change. It's a sea change in one of the most important cultural phenomena that has ever hit North America, which is feminism. Feminism came in the 60s, and it just swept like a wave across us. It swept like a wave to such a degree that sexual harassment, that everyone in this room lives with sexual harassment. Your children may live with sexual harassment. You know how old sexual harassment is? Sexual harassment began in 1978. That was the first time the term was coined in a book by Lynn Fairley. It was in 1979. Catherine MacKinnon wrote a book about the legal ramifications of sexual harassment. That's when it legally entered the system. Yet every single person in this room is living with that. And we should be somehow heartened by this to some degree. However evil that was, it was a great evil, but it was a great evil accomplished in a small period of time. And perhaps it can be reversed in as short a period of time and pushed back. But there is this sea change going on. So I want to basically let people know that we have a profound difference that's happening. What I want to do is touch upon how individualist feminism and radical feminism differs in ideas, in their attitudes, and in their approach. After that, touch upon what I think is the most important job that feminism challenges, that feminism faces right now today. And then give you a whirlwind tour of the issues that individualist feminism takes a stand on and how they basically deal with those things. So, beginning with that, it's necessary actually to back up one step and ask a more fundamental question. Ask, in fact, the most fundamental question that can be asked of any discipline, anything. And that is, what is it? I've said I-feminism, I've said radical feminism, I've said gender feminism. What is feminism? What is it? Well, I could say that feminism is the idea, the political science, the ideology that women should be equal to men. And as simple as that statement sounds, if I'm defining feminism in that way, we're already in trouble. Because what does equality mean? How is the term being defined? For example, does it refer to equality under existing laws and existing institutions, which requires only that the current society that we live in be reformed? Or is the definition of equality more revolutionary, requiring that existing laws and institutions be uprooted and replaced so that society becomes fundamentally different than what we see around us right now? Now, the manner in which equality is defined has been and is a litmus test in defining and distinguishing the various different brands of feminism, each from the other. Throughout most of the 19th century and the 20th centuries, mainstream American feminism defined equality as equal treatment under existing law and equal representation in existing institutions. That's what the drive for suffrage was in the 19th century. That's what the ERA was in the 20th century. The goal was not revolution. It was reform. Mainstream feminism said, treat us equally under existing law, give us equal representation within existing institutions. Those feminists who were more revolutionary protested that the source of injustice to women were the existing laws and the existing institutions, and as such, they could not be reformed. They were inherently unjust. There was something inherently wrong about them. They had to be swept away, and society, to some degree, had to be rebuilt according to a new vision. Again, in simple terms, the two most revolutionary traditions were socialist feminism, from which radical feminism largely draws, and individualist feminism, of which current I-feminism is a continuation. These two traditions believed that equality required revolution, but they differed dramatically about the paths, the direction that those revolutions would take. To socialist feminists, equality was a socio-economic goal. Women could be equal only by eliminating capitalism and the other institutions that were said to favor men, such as the traditional family and the church. They said, don't reform capitalism. Sweep it away. Don't include women in the injustice that is the free market. Get rid of the injustice. Let's start with a clean economic slate. As socialist feminism evolved through the 19th into the late 20th century, it became what the key theorist of the 1970s called post-Marxist feminism. But the goals remain basically the same. A legal restructuring of society to ensure an even distribution of wealth and power through comparable worth, for example. But the revolution, as I said, of I-feminism was diametrically opposed and took a totally different path. To them, equality was achieved when the human rights of individuals were achieved and were fully recognized and acknowledged by the law and by institutions in a gender-blind manner. The basic rights of human beings being that to person and to property. of individuals, including the free market, because that is basically the right of individuals to freely trade their labor and to own their property. Laissez-faire capitalism. The revolution it envisions is the sweeping away of all laws and all institutions that hinder individual rights and liberty, that hinder the equal liberty of all human rights, male or female. Now, I've said the word individual a lot rather than woman or man. Where does this emphasis on individual rights come from? In the 19th century, I-feminism arose from abolitionism, the radical anti-slavery movement in the 1830s, which declared every human being, white, black, male, female, every human being, simply by being human, to being a self-owner. That is, every person had a jurisdiction, a moral right to their own body and to the products of their own body, their labor, their property. In fighting for the rights of slaves, abolitionist women began to ask themselves a question, ask themselves a very basic question. They asked, do we not have these rights as well? The abolitionist Abby Kelly observed, quote, we have good cause to be grateful to the slave. In striving to strike his irons off, we found most surely that we were manacled ourselves, end quote. What manacled them were laws that discriminated against women in a manner that was strikingly similar to how they discriminated against blacks. If you looked in the law, the wording is incredible. You may take the word wife out and put black or slave in, and the clause of the law is almost identical. In short, the original I-feminists sought to destroy the institution of slavery. It was revolutionary, and to rewrite the law from scratch so that it made no distinction between man and woman. It spoke only of human rights. That was its revolutionary vision. All human beings have the same rights, and the law and institutions should be gender, ethnic, race blind. What does all this mean in modern terms? I began by saying there was an ideological war between the two extreme traditions of feminism in terms of ideas, attitudes, and their mode of operation in society. First, the clash of ideas. And we may as well use equality since we're there already. For 21st century radical feminism, equality remains a socio-economic goal. But a cultural goal has been added. The goal of compulsory respect for women through measures such as sexual harassment laws, by which I don't mean laws that punish the physical aggression against women. Laws against battery and assault have been there for a very long time and could handle those well. I mean specifically the laws that restrict and repress what attitudes can be expressed toward women, what language can be used to express those attitudes toward women. To 21st century I-feminists, equality still means equal treatment with men under just laws, laws that protect person and property. I-feminism says nothing about forcibly redistributing anything, wealth, power, except that force should play no role in human interaction. I-feminism says to the law, to government, protect my body, protect my person, do it equally with that of a man, and then leave me the hell alone. But what of respect for women? The I-feminists I know, and certainly myself, care deeply about women being treated better by our culture, not just by law, but by individuals and interactions. But law is not the way to change culture. You do not change peaceful behavior that is offensive by the barrel of a gun. And that's what law is, what government ultimately is. Rule by the barrel of a gun. Guns can be used in self-defense, in defending your person and your property against physical assault, but the law has no place whatsoever in regulating attitudes and words. And so, regarding respect for women, how culture expresses its respect for women, iFeminism says, if you dislike pornography in your local store, if you object to the discriminatory hiring habits of a business that's in your neighborhood, then you should use all the nonviolent means you have at your disposal to change them. Education, protest, picketing, boycott, moral suasion, use the whole slate of persuasive nonviolent strategies. What an iFeminist, what you cannot do, at least not do and be consistent with your principles, is to use force to restrict words and attitudes, because these are nothing more than other people exercising their right to free speech and their right to freedom. Now, this springboards into the question of cultural attitudes in general. And I want to focus in on attitudes toward men in order to contrast radical and iFeminism. Radical feminism tells us that men and women are separate political classes whose interests inherently clash. That's what patriarchy is. That's its definition. White male culture that necessarily oppresses women. Men and women are separate political classes, and the foregoing statement is quite distinct. This is a very distinct statement from saying that men and women differ significantly, to say they're different classes whose interests conflict. I'm talking about the supposed political class conflict between men and women, the gender war that lies at the root of radical feminism. And since this theory of class conflict is key to the radical feminist whole view of they're seen as anti-male, and I believe they are anti-male. I believe it is embedded within their theory. Bear with me while I keep hitting on theory, because it's very important to understand the two attitudes toward men between radical and iFeminism. Class warfare has been declared by radical feminism. But what is a class? A class is nothing more than an arbitrary grouping of people or things that share common characteristics that are useful to whomever is defining the category. For example, a researcher studying drug addiction might break his research subjects into those who use heroin, those who use cocaine. It's defined by anything from hair color, deodorant use, age, sex, whatever is useful to a definer. For radical feminism, gender is a common characteristic where the dividing line is put politically. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that choice. There's nothing wrong with that. Many fields use gender as dividing lines. For example, doctors will very often use female, split their patient load into male and female. They'll screen females for breast cancer, they'll screen males for prostate problems. It makes sense. But medicine does not claim, as radical feminism claimed, that the basic interests of men and women conflict, that sexes share the same basic biology, and medicine recognizes this, and that the sexes require the same basic approach of nutrition, exercise, oxygen, and a common sense lifestyle. There is no attempt in that division to deny the shared humanity of men and women.